Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today we visit the University of New England's Center for Global Humanities in Portland. We join Jason Brennan, Professor of Strategy, Economics, Ethics, and Public Policy at Georgetown University, and he's making the case against democracy as a fair, efficient form of government. Introducing our speaker today will be Anwar Majid, Director of the Center for Global Humanities.
Jason Brennan, he's the Robert J. and Elizabeth Flanagan Family Chair and Provost Distinguished Associate Professor of Strategy, Economics, Ethics, and Public Policy at the McDonnell School of Business at Georgetown University. Starting in spring 2018, he will, concurrent with his position at Georgetown, be a research professor at the University of Arizona's Freedom Center and Department of Political Economy and Moral Science. From what I understand, it's him and Noam Chomsky both have been recruited by University of Arizona to be more or less in the same kind of department and center. He specializes in politics, philosophy, and economics. It is an incredible combination of disciplines. He is the author of over 7 books, including When All Else Fails, Resistance, Violence, and State Injustice, published by Princeton. It's going to be published by Princeton in 2018. In Defense of Openness, Global Justice as Global Freedom, also to be published by Oxford University Press in 2018. And with Bas van der Voorsen, that book is published with Bas van der Voorsen, excuse my pronunciation, and Against Democracy, which came out 2 years ago from Princeton University Press. He's currently writing Cracks in the Ivory Tower, The Bad Business Ethics of Higher Ed, with Phil Magnus, and The Contract with Oxford University Press, expected publication in 2019. So as you could see, we are lucky tonight to have Jason give us his talk against democracy. So please help me welcome him to the podium.
Thank you very much for spending the evening with me, and it's nice to be back in Portland. I guess it's been about 10 years since I've been back here, though I grew up in southern New Hampshire and northern Mass, so I've probably been here about 30 or so times. It's changed a little bit since I was last here. A lot more bakeries, I think. That seems to be the thing. Bakeries and craft beer. Right. I would have come more often if that had been here when I was still living in New England. With that, I want to just jump right into it and to ask about, when you think about, government does a lot of really good things that makes our lives better. It also does a lot of bad things that makes our lives and other people's lives worse. And we want to ask, who's to blame for that? Whose fault is it that government does bad things? Well, luckily, there's all sorts of people to blame. You can blame the corporations that do various things, that engage in rent-seeking and crony capitalism and rig the government rules for their own benefit. You can blame various unions that do the same kind of behavior. You can blame my neighbors, right, the bureaucrats they live among, who sometimes play by their own rules rather than the rules they should be playing by. You can blame the Congress people. You can blame all sorts of people, special interest groups. And all of them deserve a finger wagging. But after we're done wagging our finger at all these people, we have to do this. Because at the end of the day, democracy does work pretty well, and to some degree that should scare you, because democracy is in fact responsive to the interest and the expressed public opinions of lay people. But what if the lay people don't really know what they're doing? Right? So think about any given election. In any given election, one of the major issues will be economic issues. Should we have this kind of trade? Should we have certain kinds of protectionism? Should we spend money here? Should we tax this? These are economic issues. But what if the average voter would fail basic Econ 101, as in fact they would? We're often talking about foreign policy and issues of war and peace and justice. What if the average voter has no clue what the countries are that we're currently bombing, where they are, and what they're like, as in fact they don't? We're often talking about issues of justice with regard to criminal law and what we should do with regard to reforming criminals. But what if the average voter has no clue how any of that works, as in fact they don't? Well, then probably what will happen is voters will end up voting for subpar candidates and subpar policies, candidates and policies and parties that they would not support if only they were better informed. And that's the worry, that that's what's going on with democracy. So I have here a picture of my in-laws. My kids call them Gran-Gran and Pop-Pop. So they're wonderful people. They're better people than I am, frankly. They're elders in their church. They give significant portions of their money, their income to charity. They babysit for my sister-in-law every week. They've done nice favors for me, like driven my, when I got my first job out of grad school, they drove my car across the country for me so I could fly there really quickly. And how do I repay them? I repay them by using them as an example in this talk. Right? So the thing is, they're virtuous, wonderful, kind, like people when it comes to their daily lives. But when they enter the sphere of politics, things change. They suddenly become worse people. So they might do things like they're committed Democrats, and they might watch Republican television, say Bill O'Reilly back when he was still on, in order to get angry at him, in order to experience self-righteous indignation so they can then like throw coat hangers at his face on the TV. They're the kind of people who are, they're very friendly, but if they learn things about you, like if they're they're Democrats, if they learn that you're a Republican, they might decide not to be your friend anymore. They're not so interested in being your friend. They might start thinking, maybe you're kind of a bad person. And further, like, they're not really interested in hearing, say, issues that they might disagree with. So once in a while, they'll ask me, like, oh, Jay, you know, you're reading all these political science journals. What do political scientists have to say about, say, the issue of campaign finance reform? And I'll say, well, actually, there's this research, and it says this and this. And the reaction is, I don't agree with that. They must be a bunch of Republican shills. Even though I'm like, no, they're moderate Democrats. No, they're a bunch of Republican shills. And they'll stomp off and kind of like pout for the rest of the night. They don't really want to disagree. Now, the kind of behavior that you see there, unfortunately, that's pretty common when it comes to voter behavior. There's nothing particularly wrong with them. That kind of behavior is normal when it comes to politics. And that should scare us. So the great feminist author, a political economist, early liberal thinker, John Stuart Mill, political economist John Stuart Mill, wrote a pamphlet called Considerations on Representative Government. And in this book, he had a hypothesis about what representative government would do to us. He thought, if you take the average factory worker, say working in Manchester, England, and you get that person to engage in politics, that's going to expand his mind and expand his heart. Because for me to engage in politics and to think about how to run my government, I have to learn about your interests and your interests and your interests, which means I'll not be so narrowly focused on my self-interest and start thinking about the country or the world as a whole. And further, in order to make good decisions about whom to vote for, who my member of parliament will be, I'm going to have to think about policy. And so he thought getting people to engage in politics would be like getting a fish to discover that there's a world outside the ocean. The thing is, though, he's writing this in like the 1850s. There wasn't a lot of experiments with real democracy, and he didn't really know. He had an untested scientific hypothesis, but he didn't know if he was right. Joseph Schumpeter had a much different view of what democracy to do us, with, to us, a much more pessimistic view. He says, quote, "The typical citizen drops down to a lower level of mental performance as soon as he enters the political field. He argues and analyzes in a way which he would readily recognize as infantile within the sphere of his real interests. He becomes a primitive again." Schumpeter, writing like after Mill, thought politics stultifies and corrupts us. It makes us mean and dumb. But also, he didn't really have the evidence to back up his claims. The thing is, now we do. So basically, since the late 1950s in the U.S. and in other countries, since the late 1950s and so on in various countries, we have been studying voter behavior. We've been studying what voters know, how much they know, and how they process information. And as a result, we now actually have a lot of data about how people think or whatever it is that voters are doing. And unfortunately, the evidence seems to go much more with Schumpeter than it goes along with Mill. So there's tremendous variation in what voters are like. There's variation in whether they have opinions. Some people have an opinion on everything. Some people have no opinions. On how strongly they hold those opinions. On how they react to people with whom they disagree. On what knowledge they have. On how they process information. And even though there's all this variation, you can basically lump most people into one of two categories. What I call hobbits and hooligans. So if you remember the Lord of the Rings films, hobbits are these little diminutive people that don't really care about the outside world. They're not concerned about the grand existential struggle between Mordor and the free people of Middle-earth. They just want to eat their breakfast and their second breakfast and their elevensies and lunch and tea and snack and smoke their pipes and just kind of chill out and have a kind of pastoral English lifestyle. Now, the political analog of this, a political hobbit, would be a person who doesn't care much about politics, has really very little interest in it, as a result, doesn't participate much, doesn't really vote, pretty much stays home, and has no strong or fixed opinions. These kinds of people, they don't really know much about politics. The main reason they don't know much is because they simply don't care. And the typical non-voter in the U.S. is a hobbit so described. If you look around the world in voluntary voting systems, the people who choose to stay home are political hobbits. They don't care much about politics, they don't know much about it, and that's why they don't participate and they don't vote. Then there are the other people, whom I call hooligans. All right, so I've been to soccer games in countries that actually care about soccer. Like I was in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and saw like the Sao Paulo state team versus the Sao Paulo city team. And there it was a real, extravagant show. They wouldn't even let people from opposing teams sit in the same side of the stadium. And you had to go about 3 kilometers out of your way to get to the other side because they thought people would fight, right? And they did. I saw it happen. Now, if you think about soccer hooligans, they know a lot about soccer. They can tell you like what happened in the World Cup game in 1966 and what the score was 40 minutes in. But at the same time, they're also very biased in the way they process this information. They know more, but they're biased. So think about it this way. Like my brother-in-law, unfortunately, is a Yankees fan, right? So let's imagine like we're watching the Red Sox and the Yankees, and like one of our guys comes sliding into home plate, and the umpire calls him out. I'm like, is he blind? Obviously he was safe. And my brother-in-law is like, well, of course he was out. We're seeing the same exact information, but we process that information in a way that flatters what we'd like to believe. Or take another example. Tom Brady was accused of deflating various footballs and getting an advantage from that. So people from New England, what do they think? Was he guilty or not?
No,
they get the right answer. He's not guilty, right? And people in the rest of the country, they think he's guilty. Now, it's not like, despite some connections I have, it's not like I can be like, I called up Bob Kraft and I'm like, Bob, is he really guilty or not? I have no clue. But when I hear these being accused, I'm like, but I love Tom Brady and I love the Patriots, so of course I think he's not guilty. And the rest of the country, they're really jealous that our team beats theirs all the time, so of course they want him to be guilty. So the political analog of this would be really the typical voter in the U.S. Those voters have higher levels of information. They're not completely ignorant. They know something, but they're also incredibly biased. They're when they seek out news, they only look for news that confirms whatever they already believe. They don't read the news to find out what's true. They read the news to find out they're right. So if you're a Republican, what do you watch? And if you're a Democrat, what do you watch? Yeah, and if you're something else, if you're a Marxist, you'll read like some Marxist magazine, I don't know what they are. And then if you're like a libertarian, you'll read some libertarian websites. And if you're a green, you'll read some green, like Mother Jones or something. People will pick the news source that tells them that they were correct all along, and that's what they'll do. Further, they tend to be antagonistic towards people with whom they disagree. Now it's the case where most people in the country choose to live in zip codes where they're surrounded by like-minded voters, and most of their friends and their families and loved ones are people that they agree with. So this would be the typical voter in the U.S. Finally, I bring up a group called Vulcans. Vulcans, if you've ever seen Star Trek, are these dispassionate people who just want to know what's true, and they think about everything in a scientific way. Now, it's not that I think I'm a Vulcan, but the reason I bring them up is because when you read a lot of literature about how democracy is supposed to go, it in a sense imagines that we're Vulcans. So one way of like putting John Stuart Mill's thesis is, Mill thinks we're all hobbits, but if we participate in politics, we'll become Vulcans. Schumpeter thinks we're all basically hooligans and hobbits, and if we participate in politics, we'll become even more hooliganish. And unfortunately, the evidence largely confirms Schumpeter rather than Mill. Why would this be the case? What's going on here? Why do people behave badly when it comes to politics? So unfortunately, it's an incentive problem. It's an incentive problem that is baked into the very fabric of democracy. People don't know much about politics, and they reason about it in a bad way because the incentives are all wrong. So to illustrate, imagine I'm about to cross the street. What do? I look both ways, right? And so I'm crossing the street, and I see what appears to be a Mack truck barreling towards me at 60 miles an hour. And a thought occurs to me. That's not an ordinary Mack truck. That's Optimus Prime, my childhood hero from the Transformers, coming to take me on an adventure to fight Megatron together. Right? Now, would I dare indulge that fantasy? Probably not, because if I'm wrong, right, dead. And I used to be an insurance adjuster, so I can tell you some people do that. But those people over time learn not to one way or another. So the reason I process this information rationally is not because I find traffic patterns intrinsically interesting. It's not because I'm into that. It's because I will be punished for being wrong and rewarded for being right. That information is useful to me, and thinking about it in a clear way is important because of the way the world works. But what if the incentives were different? So imagine that you were in a classroom like this one, but even bigger, Like I think at UC Berkeley, they have classes that have like 1,000 students in them. So imagine you're taking one of those classes. It's like Econ 101. And on the first day of class, the professor says, all right, class, here's how this class works. 15 weeks from now, we're going to take a final exam. That final exam will be worth 100% of your grade. But I'm an egalitarian, so I'm not going to give you your grade. I'm not going to give you your grade. Rather, I'm going to average all of your grades together, and everyone will get exactly the same grade. How much would you study? How much would you study? Not very much, probably. Some of you would, but probably most people won't. And in fact, economists have done this as an experiment, and people don't study. The average grade ends up being an F. The reason for that is not because the students lack virtue, it's not because they're stupid, it's not because they're corrupt, it's because the incentives are bad. If I say to everybody, you're all getting the same grade, and there's 1,000 of you, so you can't control each other's behavior, then you basically know most people are going to slack off. If I try really hard, I'll still get an F. If I slack off, I'll get an F. Everyone thinks the same thing, and no one studies. The problem is the incentives. But if you think about it, voting is pretty much the same thing, except rather than having 1,000 students, you have in the U.S. 210 million, right? Your vote, unfortunately, just doesn't matter very much. Your vote actually matters maybe a little bit more than mine, but it doesn't matter very much. Economists disagree about what is the chance that your vote will make a difference, right? And there's some disagreement on this. On the most optimistic model in the literature, you can have as high as about a 1 in 20 million chance of being decisive on the presidential election, but only if you live in one of a few swing states, right? So who here, is anyone here from Massachusetts? No? All right, their votes like never count. That's fine. They're all, we called them massholes when I was growing up. We don't care about them anyways. You know, most of you are from Maine, right? So I think on that model, you have about a 1 in 100 million chance of being decisive. Two elections ago, when I was living in Virginia, I had like it was 1 in 20 million chance. But most people, they have about a 1 in a trillion chance. If you're from California and so on, like no chance at all. And that's on the optimistic model. On the more pessimistic model, your chances of being decisive in a presidential election are roughly on par with the chances that when you sit down, you will spontaneously quantum tunnel through your chair, right? It can happen, but it probably won't. Now, voters, when we go and poll them, if you're like, do you think your vote matters? They all say yes. And then we're like, do you think you have a chance of actually making a difference? And you really press them on this? They're like, no. They know. They know better. And they behave as such. They recognize that this is how democracy is meant to work. It's not supposed to empower you as an individual. It's supposed to empower the collective. And it does. But the problem with that is that that means that you're voting, and you're voting one way, voting the other way, and staying home are roughly the same effect. So just to give you an example of this, imagine like it's the year 2008. In 2008, I'm living in Seekonk, Massachusetts. I was working in Rhode Island. And imagine that then candidate President Obama calls me and says, hey, Jay, if I win, not if you vote for me, but if I win, I will guarantee the Treasury will pay you $10 million. Now, in that case, I'd have a pretty strong desire for him to win, even more than whatever my desire was already. But it wouldn't make sense for me to vote for him. If I'm selfish, I might just stay home and play video games. In fact, it turned out that even on that presupposition, I have a higher chance of dying on the way to the voting booth in a car crash than I have of being the decisive voter. So him winning is worth $10 million. My vote for him is worth not even a trillionth of a penny. In the same way, winning the lottery is worth, you know, $100 million, but a lottery ticket is worthless and you shouldn't buy them. So all this then explains why voters behave the way they do when we study them. Voters are, in short, nice, but ignorant and irrational. What I mean by nice is as follows. When I ask you, like, you, sir, like, when you vote, do you vote your pocketbook or do you vote for what's good and just? Probably you're like, I vote for what's good and just, right? But when you ask people that, they're like, well, I personally vote for justice and peace and prosperity and love, but my neighbors, they all vote their pocketbooks and their wallets. We're all right about ourselves and wrong about our neighbors. In fact, self-interest is a very weak predictor of voter behavior. It has very little effect on how we vote. And that seems weird because people are overall quite selfish. You know, for example, you could all spend like a large percent of your income feeding like desperately poor people in the rest of the world, and most of us don't do it, right? So we're pretty selfish overall. But it makes sense when it comes to politics, because if you're selfish, you won't bother vote in the first place. It's not worth it from a self-interested point of view. So in fact, when you look at how people vote, they're what we call nationalist sociotropes, which means people usually vote for what they perceive is the national interest. Now, that doesn't mean their perceptions are right, but they vote with good intentions. Their hearts are good. The problem is with what's going on up here. They're nice, but they're ignorant and they're irrational. What I mean by ignorant is they know very little. And the reason we know this is because we've done all these studies. So every 2 years for like about 50, 60 years now, something is done called the American National Election Studies. One of my neighbors actually does this study. She like conducts it. They interview thousands and thousands of voters every couple of years. They ask them a battery of questions. During these studies, they ask them questions about just the basic facts relevant to the election. Which party controls Congress? Who tends to be more conservative, the Democrats or the Republicans? Who's more conservative, this candidate or that candidate? What's the unemployment rate? Is it going up or down? Can you estimate it within 5 percentage points? Right? When they ask people these questions, here's what they find. The top 25% of voters, they get like an A- on this quiz. And remember, this is like basic info. It's not Econ 101. It's not Sociology 101. It's just basic stuff, the stuff you can Google. The middle 50% of voters, they do equivalent to chance. So we don't know if they know a quarter of the answers or they just don't. They're just guessing. The bottom 25% of voters do worse than chance. So in 1996, they say, all right, voters, who's more conservative, Bill Clinton or Bob Dole? And they're like, Bill Clinton. Who's more conservative on average, the Democrats or the Republicans? Oh, the Democrats. Right? They get that wrong. They do worse than chance. Ignorance would actually be a blessing. They're worse than ignorant. And this has been going on for 60 years. It's actually not any better or worse now. What's interesting is it hasn't gotten any better. Americans are more educated on paper, but ignorance is the same. We now have these devices in our pockets that we can use to access all the world's information instantly, and ignorance hasn't budged. So what's being dominated by is the incentive problem. And by the way, I mean, I often lecture about this stuff in other parts of the world, and people are always like, well, Americans are especially dumb. And it's like, no, not on this. Like, they're actually the same. Germans don't know anything. The Dutch don't know anything. Swedish people don't know anything. Ignorance is widespread at every major modern democracy. I guess the Swiss are a little bit better for whatever reason. Right? So, and it's been like this forever. Even like in 1964, they ask voters, hey, voters, is NATO, is the USSR part of NATO? You know, the USSR, we almost had nuclear war with a year and a half ago. Are they part of NATO? You know, that military alliance we have that's created to control the USSR and contain them? And fewer than half of voters knew the answer, right? And this is true with the rest of the world. Take the Brexit decision, the recent Brexit decision, right? So after that, a polling firm called Ipsos Mori polled a bunch of voters both before and afterward, and they asked them some questions with regard to that decision. They said, let's imagine you're the Remain voters and you're the Leave voters. They say, Remain voters, what percent of the UK is made up of European immigrants? You say, I don't know, about 15%. 40%, truth about 5%. How much money do we spend on a particular welfare program that goes to basically mothers with dependent children and the money gets sent to Europe, right, to the poorer parts of Europe? Estimate that for me. The remain voters, you overestimate by a factor of about 40. The leave voters, you overestimate it by a factor of about 100, right? How much money comes from the European Union in terms of foreign investment? You get it wrong, they get it really wrong. All these questions that were relevant to that election, the Remain voters were wrong, and the Leave voters were even more wrong. And the closer you were to the truth, the more likely it was you were going to vote Remain. You see this kind of thing everywhere. Now, none of this would matter if information had no effect on our voting preferences. But in fact, it does. And the way we can test this is by using things like the American National Election Studies. Because when they do these tests, they collect 3 bits of information. The first bit is they find out who you are. Because things like whether you live in the coasts, whether you live in a rural part of the country, what religion you are, your ethnic identity, your sexual identity, your income, your employment status, these things have an effect on your voting behavior. In fact, a very strong effect. So they get that information. They then give people a quiz about what they know, and they give them a quiz about what they want. What are your policy preferences? When we have these 3 sets of information, who you are, what you want, and what you know, we can then, using first semester graduate level statistics and any newspaper could check, determine what would happen if I waved a magic wand and I made the American public exactly the same demographically but fully informed. Do their policy preferences change at all? A priori, we don't know. It's just an empirical question. What if I waved a magic wand and made them perfectly ignorant? What would their policy preferences be? So what's interesting is lots of different people have done this kind of study with different sets of data, not just the American National Election Studies, but other forms of data as well. And you consistently find these results. the enlightened public, a hypothetical American public that was fully informed on this basic quiz, would overall prefer a little bit less government control and intervention in the economy. They don't turn libertarian, but they move slightly in that kind of like less interventionist direction. They favor more free trade. They favor more equality for homosexuals. They tend to think that we should have pro-choice legislation, even if they think that abortion is wrong. They go, yeah, but we shouldn't criminalize it because it doesn't work. They tend to favor tax increases to offset the deficit, so not lower taxes, but higher taxes. They tend to favor less punitive measures on crime, a less hawkish military policy, and increased immigration. What's interesting about this is that this set of policies does not correspond to the Democrats, it doesn't correspond to the Republicans, it doesn't quite correspond to the Greens, Libertarians, or anyone else, but you find this convergence among high information voters, even within one party. So Princeton political scientist Martin Gillens did a study like this just looking at Democrats, and he said high-information Democrats are pro-gay rights, low-information Democrats, anti-gay rights. High-information Democrats were anti-second Iraq war, low-information Democrats were pro-second Iraq war, and so on. You get differences just within a single party. All right? That's just ignorance. That's just knowledge. But it gets worse. It gets worse because it's not just about what we know, but also how we process information. So one problem is that we tend to look for information that just corresponds with what we already like to believe. We just try to find out that we're right. But there are other biases that we have as well. A really prevalent one is something called intergroup bias. The idea behind intergroup bias is that you see yourself as a member of a group and you're antagonistic towards members of other groups. So early studies on this weren't even looking at politics. There was a guy named Henri Tajfel who would do these studies where he'd get a bunch of people like you in a room who didn't know each other, and he'd give you a quiz. The quiz would be a lie. It would be nonsense. And then at the end, he'd lie to you, and he'd say, based upon this quiz you've taken, I'm going to group you into two different groups. It turns out that you on this side of the room prefer one kind of art, and you on this side of the room prefer a different kind of art. You prefer polypropodactyl art, and you prefer monopropodactyl art. Those words mean nothing. They're nonsense, right? Then he would have them play games with each other, and immediately, on the basis of these minimal groupings and nonsense things, they would be mean to people in the other group, right? I do things like, you're the polypropodactyl people. You've never interacted with anyone in your group or anyone over here, and I'll take a random person from the other group, and I'll be like, how smart and trustworthy and good is this person? You're like, probably kind of dumb and untrustworthy. All right, random person from your group. Oh, smart and trustworthy and a good person. This is on the basis of nothing. Right? It gets worse when it becomes race and nationality and especially politics. Nowadays, people, this actually has gotten worse over time. People are extremely partyist. We tend to only be friends with people in our political party. We tend to try to work in workplaces where people share our politics. That's especially true if we're white, educated, and privileged. We almost always work with like-minded people. And we're antagonistic towards those with whom we disagree. It's rare for people to have genuine cross-cutting political discussions. And one of my favorite books on politics is by the political scientist Diana Mutz at the University of Pennsylvania. It's called Hearing the Other Side. If you read a book on politics, read mine, but after that, read Hearing the Other Side. She goes around asking people questions like, okay, you're a committed Democrat. Can you explain to me why anyone would be Republican? So if you answer as follows, as many people do, oh, easy, because they're stupid and evil. That predicts you vote frequently and often, you give money to multiple causes, and you're a committed member of the party. On the other hand, if I say, you see yourself as a Democrat, can you explain to me why someone might be a Republican? And you go, well, I disagree with them, but here's what they think. And you can actually explain their point of view in a way that they find appealing. That predicts you don't vote, you stay at home, you don't give any money to causes. That might seem weird, but think about it. When you see street preachers, they're always like, you never see a street preacher who's like, this is the word of God and you need to read it, but you should also read the Quran too because you should learn about other religions and be open-minded, right? The street preachers are true believers, and the people who participate the most in politics are also the true believers. So, all right, I've given you so far everything I've said is basically kind of uncontroversial as far as political science goes. It's just what the studies show. Now I want to talk about the question of the nature of democracy. What should we think about it? Is democracy just? Well, I want to say one thing. Even though I wrote a book with a angry-sounding title called Against Democracy, we did that to sell books, frankly, it is a good system. It does work pretty well overall. But the question is there anything better, and how would we know? And is there any injustice involved with the fact that people are ignorant? I think there is a worry that there is a degree of injustice involved with political ignorance. And so to illustrate this, imagine as follows. you are being accused of capital murder, first-degree murder, and we have a trial, and this is your jury. And during the trial, we just don't pay any attention to the facts of the case. We're just like on our phone looking up Reddit pictures of cats. And then we go back to deliberate, and we're like, all right, it's time to deliberate. Is he guilty? And we're like, did you pay any attention? No. How about you? No. Well, I don't. We have like the transcript here. I guess we could read it. That'd be really boring. How about we just flip a coin? Heads. All right, you're guilty. In that case, we would think we acted unjustly. And in fact, you'd be entitled to a new trial if you could prove the jury did that. What if instead of that, we're like, you know, I think he's from Morocco. Let's just call him. Let's just say he's guilty because we don't like Moroccans. All right? That would be unjust. What if we're like, I think he might be one of those lizard people that rules the world, the reptilians. There is this thing called the reptilian conspiracy, and on polls, about 4% of Americans say they believe it. We don't know if they really believe it or they're just messing with the pollsters. But all right. So we just decide the case incompetently. You would think that's unjust. So what's going on here is your life, liberty, property, and happiness are at stake. And we, the jury, have been charged with deciding the justice of this case. And if we decide out of ignorance, out of malice, out of malfeasance, out of incompetence, out of bias, out of spite, out of self-interest to mess with your rights, we've acted unjustly. I think something like that holds with regard to the electorate, too. If the electorate imposes its will upon the, or anyone who really has power over others, decides without good faith and incompetently, I think that's unjust. Now, you might think there's a disanalogy here because you think, well, we the people rule ourselves. It's not quite right. Because on one hand, the majority of the moment, even they don't agree on everything, but even the majority of the moment, they're imposing their will upon the minority. They're imposing their will upon people who can't vote, upon children who have to put up with the situation, upon foreigners who live elsewhere who are affected by the decisions, upon residents who are affected. You know, when I think about you're making decisions for yourself. Like if I wanted to just eat a bag of Cadbury mini eggs, like a whole pound of it every day for the rest of my life, it's a bad choice. But when I do that, I'm basically only hurting myself. We are deciding for everybody, which makes it a matter not of personal preference, but of justice. So with that, I want to talk about what kind of value, if any, does democracy have? When you think about the value that, say, a hammer has, you know, unless it's like your grandma's hammer that's sentimental to you, it's just a tool. Hammers are useful tools, and that's it. They have what we call instrumental value. And no one would ever insist on using a hammer if it's a case where you need a wrench, where a wrench is called for, or where a screwdriver is called for, right? And you wouldn't insist on using a hammer if you had an even better hammer. So does democracy have that kind of value? In a second, I'm going to say, yeah, it does. It's good. It's a useful tool for generating good outcomes. But most people don't simply think democracy is a useful tool for generating good outcomes. They think it has other kinds of value as well. They think it has the kind of value that a piece of art has. When it comes to art, we don't just care about what monetary value it has or how it's useful. We care about things like who made it. So if Picasso scribbles on a napkin, that's worth like $50,000. If I make an identical scribble on a napkin, I just ruin the napkin. Right? We also care about what it symbolizes and evokes and how it makes us feel. And there are people that say that democracy is kind of like a painting. It's good because of what it symbolizes and expresses. And finally, there are people that say that democracy has the kind of value that people have. There are ends in them, it's an end in itself, apart from its effects. So my view is really that democracy is a hammer, nothing more. It's actually a really good hammer, but that's all it is. And if we can find a better hammer, we can feel free to use it. And the question is there a better hammer? So is it a good hammer? Yes. Democratic countries tend to have more economic freedom. They tend to give their citizens more personal power to make economic decisions. This turns out not to be a mere correlation, but there's a causal relationship between these two things. It also turns out that democratic countries tend to give their citizens much more civil liberty, like they have more freedom of expression, more freedom of religion, more freedom of lifestyle. And this is not a mere coincidence or mere correlation. It's causal. There's reason to think these things go together. It also turns out that democratic countries tend to be richer, that they tend to have more money than non-democratic countries, and that their citizens do better, including the poor. Like even the citizens at the bottom tend to do better than citizens in non-democratic countries. So democracy delivers the goods pretty well, but it's still not perfect. We might ask, can it do anything better? Here's where most people are going to say, ah, it's just as an end in itself. It's inherently just apart from its effects. We can't even experiment with anything different. One argument they'll make is something like this. They'll say, democracy is good because it's fair. It gives everybody an equal shot at getting their way. The problem, though, as you know, your former professor and my former colleague, Dave Eslin, down at Brown University would say, if all you care about is fairness, you don't need to vote. You can flip a coin. You can put policy preferences on a dartboard and throw darts. These are other ways of making decisions that are actually more fair, right? And one reason to think about that, in reality, democracy doesn't give everyone equal chance. So imagine, like, let's say you're like a really radical Marxist. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand if you are. Or like you're like a radical libertarian. Or you're like a Native American, right? You never get your way, right? Because you're always going to be outvoted by the majority, right? The majority gets its way. You're what's called a persistent minority, and you're never going to get your way. If we actually cared about making it fair, here's what we do. We have the election, and then rather than the majority vote winning, we'd assign a probability, 40% to this candidate, 36% to this candidate, 2% to this candidate, and then we'd roll some dice. And that would mean that there's a chance that the Nazi Party would win, or there's a higher chance the Libertarian Party win, or the Green Party would win. That would be fair. That would be giving everyone an equal shot. And when you propose that, most people say, I don't want to do that because I don't want to give these fringe groups any chance of winning. And maybe you're right not to, but it shows that you care not simply about fairness, you care about the results as well. Some people say, well, democracy is good because it empowers individuals. But the problem with that is, as we talked about before, it doesn't really. Your vote just does not make much of a difference. There's no such thing as increasing a mandate. That's a myth. You really only have an effect if you decide the election, and you never will. Right, even in Florida in the year 2000, people were like, it was decided by 400 votes, so doesn't that show us that every vote counts? Nope, the votes didn't count then either. Right, it counts only if it's a tie, and it wasn't a tie. Other people say, well, maybe it doesn't empower you, but it gives you autonomous control. It gives you some autonomy. But that doesn't really make sense either, because, again, you don't have much power. So, for example, if I wanted to know, do I have autonomous control over my left arm, I do an experiment. I'll will things to happen and see if it works. I'm going to will right now for my left arm will wave. Well, good. Now, for the scientists in the room, N equals 1, it's not a good experiment. We'd have to do this multiple times, but I've done it before. It looks like I have autonomous control over my left arm. Now I'm going to see if I have autonomous control over the gravitational pull of the Earth. I'm going to will gravity to just turn off. No, it didn't happen, right? So when voting for me is a little bit like willing gravity to turn off or the sun to turn off or the sun to set early. So, for example, I always vote for increased immigration. And as a result of all of my voting, not a single person has been allowed to stay in the country a single second longer. I vote against, say, militaristic intervention. As a result of my voting, not a single bullet has ever failed to have been fired. I vote for reducing the drug war. As a result of my voting, not a single person has ever been set free for possessing marijuana, and they never will. I just don't have that much power. We have power, but none of us as individuals do. So here most people turn to what you might call symbolic arguments. So my colleague at the University of Michigan, Elizabeth Anderson, says, we vote in part as an expression and a symbolic affirmation of our status as autonomous and self-governing beings whose considered judgments or even opinions have to be given equal weight to those of others. What she's saying is that the reason that we vote is because we have equal voting rights is because here in the U.S. and other countries, we use the right to vote as a public affirmation that we are all equally valuable. Now, she's absolutely right about that. That is, in fact, what we do with the right to vote. And that's why, historically, when we stop being such jerks, we give the right to vote to people that we thought as inferior before. It's like, women are inferior. And then when we stop thinking they're inferior, like, well, you can have the right to vote. Blacks are inferior. Oh, well, now we don't think that anymore. You can have the right to vote. As a matter of fact, we do, in fact, imbue the right to vote with all of this symbolic power. But the question is, should we? It's not obvious that it's written into the fabric of the universe that you have to use the right to vote this way. Instead of having like the right to vote mean this, you could have like a statue of equality. You could have a National Equality Day where we all talk about why we're equal. We could produce results that actually lead to egalitarian outcomes rather than just having equal votes. We could try to get more egalitarian outcomes, which might require unequal votes to achieve. There's other things we can do. My worry is that the fact that we've imbued the right to vote with all of this symbolic power is just a way we happen to think about voting. It's not in the vote itself. So to illustrate that, I want you to imagine a society like ours, but what happens in this society is when you turn 18, you get a red scarf from the government, and then you wear your scarf around, right? You wear it around in public, and that is the public affirmation from that society that you are a full and equal valued member of that society. And now let's say a new party comes to power, kind of a theocratic, fringe right-wing group, and they say, you know what, we're going to take away scarves from gay people because we don't like them. We think they're sinners. So they come to power and they remove the scarves. Now gay people don't get scarves anymore. Now, in that society, it would make sense for us to go on the streets and demand that they get the scarves back and say, how dare you take away their scarves? But we in our own world recognize it's not because scarves really have this meaning. It's not because it's like a deep feature of the universe that you have to have scarves like this. It's just because they've imbued all of this symbolic value into the scarves that suddenly to take it away is to express contempt for people. Well, what if the same thing is true about voting? So my worry here is that we should put a price on the symbolic values that we have, right? Because if it's just a symbol, we can change the symbol. So for instance, if I were to stick up my middle finger, what would that mean? It would show contempt. But we could change that. We could just decide that here in this room, if we stick up our middle fingers, that means that I value you as an end in yourself, right? Are you guys on board? Do you want to do that? Now, we have no reason to do that because it's costly, right? It's costly to do that. But what if we could discover reasons. So suppose we discovered that when you say the word go to hell, it turns out that causes vibrations in the air. When those vibrations get to your body, it causes vibrations in the molecules in your body, and it kills cancer. If we learned that, we wouldn't be like, well, we still can't say go to hell. We would just change the meaning of the English language. Similarly, if we learned that when you say, I respect you, it causes different vibrations, that when it gets to an infant, it causes SIDS. We would stop saying that, right? We would remove the symbolism with those words. Now, these are silly cases because they're hypothetical, but there are real-life cases like this. The Foray tribe of Papua New Guinea used to have a practice called endocannibalism. What they would do is at a funeral, they would eat the brains of their dead. Their reasoning for doing this was because they thought when you eat the brains of the dead, then that person lives on through you and through every subsequent generation. It's a beautiful thought. Whenever I think about that, I'm like, I kind of wish my kids would eat me. It's beautiful. Except it turns out to have a price not worth paying. It turns out that eating the brains of the dead spreads a disease, a prion-based disease, which kills you. When the Foray tribe of Papua New Guinea discovered this, they stopped doing it. So the question is, well, what if our own symbolism has these negative effects? Well, maybe we should change our symbols. But that really, whether that's true or not, depends upon whether there is a better alternative to just straight up democracy. And the answer is, we don't really know. We should maybe be open to it, but we don't really know yet. So I'm going to tell you some of the ideas that are out there right now. One idea is something called futurearchy or predictocracy. The idea behind this is we should vote on values, but we should bet on policy. There are ways of having what are called betting markets or information markets, and you use those to choose policy. The reasoning behind this is, and to sort of quote, this is a technical phrase in economics, so excuse the bad language. I've already stuck up my middle finger at you, I guess, so it's okay. A bet is a tax on bullshit. What I mean by that is, if I just say something like, imagine it's the election, and I say, Trump won, we're going to have World War III. All that happens when I say that is I either get your approval or disapproval depending upon your politics. But now imagine somebody says, oh yeah, want to bet? Well, suddenly that changes things because now, like, if you're right, you get money, and if you're wrong, you lose money. And in fact, after the election, I tried this with a bunch of people. People were like, oh, Roe v. Wade is going to be overturned. I'm like, I'll bet you $5,000 will not be overturned in the next 8 years. No one would take me up on it. Why? So the thought here is that people will only place bets if they're reasonably secure. And it turns out, like empirically speaking, that betting markets on the future have a better job predicting what works and what's going to happen than asking experts or asking lay people. So there's ways possibly of running government using betting markets. Another idea that's popular among a number of people, such as like Alex Guerrero at the University of Rutgers University and a few others, is what's called lotocracy or sortition, which is actually what they did in ancient Greece. You don't have everybody vote, but you randomly select a certain number of people, and they and only they get to vote. And the thought is, in virtue of selecting these people at random, you have a good distribution of people from all walks of life. You're not privileging one race or group or ethnic group or income group, but you're giving them more power so they have a strong incentive to be informed, and maybe they'll vote smarter. Finally, there's what's called epistocracy. Behind an epistocracy, the idea is that in some way or other, voting power is apportioned to knowledge. John Stuart Mill, the guy I mentioned earlier who was pretty optimistic about government, he actually was an epistocrat, not a democrat. What he wanted to do was everyone gets one vote, but some people get more than one vote. If you have, like, say, certain kinds of education, this is called plural voting. Now, the problem with that and maybe some of these other systems is that when we track political knowledge in the U.S., it's not evenly distributed among all groups. It happens to correlate with privilege. If you're white, if you're high income, if you're of Asian descent, if you're employed, if you live on the coasts. These are things that predict high knowledge. Being certain kinds of minorities, low income, low education, this predicts less knowledge. So the worry is that epistocracy might in some way privilege the privileged and give them more power. But there might be ways of fixing this. So one kind of epistocratic system that may be worth experimenting is what I call government by simulated oracle. This uses the enlightened preference method I mentioned earlier. In this system, what happens is everyone gets to vote, including two-year-olds. Anyone who can show up at the ballot box, you can let them vote. It won't even hurt in this system. They vote, but when they vote, they do three things. They tell us who they are. We get their demographic information. We then collect information about what they want, like which candidate they support, which party they support, if it's a referendum, what they vote for on that referendum. And finally, we give them a quiz of 20 questions of just basic political knowledge. Right? You then take those three bits of information, and instead of figuring out what the majority actually supports, you calculate what would we support if we were demographically identical but fully informed, and you do that instead. The nice thing about this is that it's a way of extracting the wisdom from the crowds, but without giving any individual an additional vote. In that system, we can't really say that you got 2.7 votes and you got 1.2 and you got 0.6, but in a sense, no one really has one vote per se. Whether that counts as democracy or epistocracy or not, that's really, in a sense, a kind of deep philosophical question. Right? So these are some possible alternatives. Would they work better? We don't really know. They're things to explore. They're things to experiment with. In the real world, all of these things will be abused and misused, but that's also true of democracy. You see that with gerrymandering and so on. So this is what I'm going to end with. Churchill famously said, "No one pretends democracy is perfect or all wise. Indeed, it's been said that democracy is the worst form of government except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time." I think he's right about that. But most people, when they quote it, they get it wrong. They say, it's the worst except for all the other ones. He says, no, it's the worst except for all the other ones that have been tried from time to time. Right? He's right about that. It does work really well overall. But we also know that it has systematic flaws, and the flaws are based upon the incentives that voting creates. So it's maybe worth now being open-minded and being willing to consider alternatives to democracy, experimenting with them on a small scale, and if they work, being willing to scale them up. And perhaps we can have even better and more just government than we currently have. I don't think we're yet at the end of history.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. On today's show, we heard from Jason Brennan, professor of strategy, economics, ethics, and public policy at Georgetown University. He spoke in Portland recently at the University of New England's Center for Global Humanities. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and for Speaking in Maine, I'm Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.